So three things in human life are important. The first is to be kind. The second is to be kind. The third is to be kind. So that's Henry James, the novelist, who said that. But I think we could very easily paraphrase that as three things in the spiritual life are important. The first is to act with metta. The second is to act with metta. The third is to act with metta. At the end of Bhante Sangharakshita's very good commentary on the Metta Sutta, Living with Kindness, he says this. The way of metta is not only a path of ever-increasing positive emotion leading to enlightenment, it is a guide to recovering our basic human inheritance of joy. So we can see metta as a path to enlightenment, a way to the goal, indeed an expression of the goal. But also, which is something I really rather like, we can see it as Bhante puts it, as recovering our human inheritance. So in other words, metta is an expression of our basic humanity, or to put it another way, to be really human is to be kind. So what I'm going to be doing in this talk is I'm going to look at metta as a path to an expression of the goal of Buddhism. But before that, I'm going to talk about a little bit about what metta is and then look at three applications of metta. Now, first of all, I feel I need to give a disclaimer. So you might think I've written a book on metta. You might think I'm a love type, a metta type. But I have to confess that I've tended to struggle with the metta bhavana. In fact, even today, if you said, would you like to do the metta bhavana or the mindfulness of breathing? Mindfulness of breathing, please. every time. So then you might think, well, so what are you doing writing a book on metta? So that the short answer is that I was asked to. This is what one has friends for. After I stopped being chair of the London Buddhist Centre, I had a bit of time off, and when I came back, my very good friend Maitreya Bandhu asked me if I would develop a follow-on from the mindfulness-based courses that we run at the London Buddhist Centre, particularly in breathing space, our health and well-being wing, on something to do with the metta bhavana. So I could immediately see that was a very good idea. We're very used to mindfulness beyond Buddhist centres becoming very popular these days in the world, and there's been a lot of work done also in our tradition as well on mindfulness. I remember that's not always been the case. I remember back in about 1991, there was an order member who gave a talk called "Is There Mindfulness in the Order?" with the implication that there wasn't. I think that's changed now. As I said, mindfulness has become much more popular both within our own tradition and outside of that. And there's, of course, Maitreya Bandhu's very good book, Life with Full Attention. So I wanted to develop a course based on the metta bhavana to follow on or to complement the mindfulness-based courses that we were running. And like the mindfulness courses, which I think are very good at sort of how to do mindfulness in daily life, I also wanted to include that. So they're looking at metta in daily life. How do we practice metta as we go about our day-to-day activities? And so I called the course Kindness Behaviour Training, KBT, because it seems you have to have initials if you're doing one. It's MBSR, MBAR, so you have to have a little set of initials, so KBT. Maitreya Bandhu and I dreamt that up in near St. Ives one day, with an emphasis on how we practice metta and how we apply metta, some of which I'll be looking at in the talk today. So also looking at what metta is and isn't. So if we want to really know what metta is, we need to be aware of our emotions. We need to be mindful of our emotions. Hence the name of the book is Mindful Emotion. So the book's a course book. it's basically an intensive course on metta, on and off the cushions, and there are also downloads. That's a little commercial, little commercial break. So to go on to what is metta, I'm going to draw quite a bit on in the talk on Bhante's Living with Kindness that I've already referred to. So here's another thing he says. Develop to its full intensity, metta is a down-to-earth care and concern directed to all living beings equally, individually and without reservation. The unfailing sign of metta is that you are deeply concerned for the well-being, happiness and prosperity of the object of your metta. He also says, metta is love that breaks out of the narrow confines of self-referential selectivity, love that does not have a preference, non-exclusive love. If we're going to use the word love at all, we could describe metta as disinterested love. It is, of course, interested in the sense of concerned. It is not uninterested, but it is disinterested in the sense that when you feel it, you have no thought of what you might get back in return. So in other words, it's about a concern. Metta is a concern for beings. It's a non-exclusive love. It's active. It's not just a feeling. And in a way, it's a very, very high ideal. So, I mean, hopefully that's sort of thing we're hopefully familiar with from practicing the metta bhavana. And of course, we often translate it as, we usually translate it as loving kindness. Although often we just leave it as metta bhavana, partly because the translation has its own is problematic. Although using the word metta itself can be problematic, because that I think can sometimes sound a bit cool. So yeah, we often translate it as loving kindness. And love, of course, the word love has got much more emotional resonance, but it's also rather vague. I mean, I love chocolate, but I probably don't feel metta for chocolate. So in the book, I've referred to it as kindness. But again, like love, the part of the problem with that is it can sound a bit sentimental. When I was giving a PowerPoint presentation on KBT, so I looked up some images of kindness, and the sort of things that came up was like a little kitten with a fluffy chick. And although some people in the audience loved that, there were lots of, I think that's a bit sentimental and not really what metta is. But yeah, I like the word kindness. Partly it's got its etymology goes back a long way. It goes back before 900 years of the Common Era, related to the old English gekind, which means something like natural, native or innate. And originally it's from the word meaning family, and we get the word kin. Comes from the same root as kindness. So in other words, what it seems to imply is that kindness is a natural state, the way that we might be naturally predisposed towards our family, family conflicts notwithstanding. So for me, it just felt a more resonant word than, certainly than the Latinate word compassion, which... When I was starting to do the course, I was looking at what else was going on in the wider sort of mindfulness world, and there's quite a lot on compassion. So there's compassion-focused therapy, there's mindfulness-based self-compassion, and various other things to do with compassion. But I preferred to use the word kindness. Nevertheless, I did draw on some bits that I found quite useful in there. One of the useful things I found when I was doing my research was from compassion-focused therapy, which was developed by Paul Gilbert, who's a professor of psychology in Derby. And in compassion-focused therapy, it draws on evolutionary psychology. And one of the things that he draws out of that is this idea that we've got three basic emotional regulation systems. So those three systems are, first of all, threat, secondly, drive, and thirdly, soothing or affiliation. So the threat system is a system, is one of our most basic systems, looks out for danger. So it's out, there's always a bit of a scanning out for danger, and then if danger is seen to be out there, we get a response of anger or fear or disgust or submission. So it's clearly a very useful system. So, you know, if we're going for a nice Buddhist walk with our friend in pairs, as we like to do sometimes, and crossing a road, and a great big bus is coming, when our threat system is working, we'll notice it and we'll get out of the way. Otherwise, you know, we'd chop and get run over. So, fortunately, our threat system generally seems to work, and we get across the road and stop chatting. Similarly, so then the second system is the drive system, and the drive system moves us towards important goals. So that can be simple things like food and sex, or more complex things like passing an exam, getting a job interview. And when we succeed, we get a little boost of pleasure. It's mediated by dopamine. It's thought to be mediated by dopamine. And as I said, it moves us towards important goals in our life. And then the third system, the soothing system, seems to be a later evolutionary thing. So what you've got with reptiles is basically their reproductive strategy, by and large, is produce lots of offspring and then let them get on with it. Whereas with warm-blooded animals, you get a change in reproductive strategy where you have fewer offspring, but you look after them. And this looking after is mediated by the soothing or affiliation system. And one of the chemicals that is particularly associated with that is oxytocin. So oxytocin, so when a mother is breastfeeding, then oxytocin helps with the breastfeeding. But it also, if you give somebody a hug, you get a little boost of oxytocin. So it's sometimes called the cuddle chemical. Oxytocin. So when you have a hug with somebody, you get a little boost of oxytocin, and that makes you feel good. But it's a sort of calmer system as opposed to the drive, which is more sort of excitable, even though it's again associated with pleasure. So we've got these three basic systems, but then in humans it gets a bit more complicated because we've got this clever mind. Sometimes referred to as a new mind, which is able to do all sorts of things like make iPads and, you know, text and complex, you know, a whole range of technological, cultural things that we're able to do with our mind. But and part of that is sort of being able to manipulate concepts and imagine things. Which, as I say, is very, very useful, but it can also get in the way. So we can imagine danger, or we can imagine fearful situations that maybe are never going to happen and get caught up in them. So whereas, you know, if you think of, let us say, a gazelle on the savannah, and if a gazelle is sort of munching away there on the savannah, having lunch, and gets a sense of a lion approaching, the threat system will be activated and the gazelle will run off. If the gazelle gets away, as far as I'm aware, the gazelle doesn't then go around and think, that was such a close call, I'm never going to that OCC, it's like really dangerous over in that part of the savannah, it's like really terrible, I'm never going there again, sort of thing. Whereas we can, with our minds, we can do that sort of thing, we can get sort of more and more sort of caught up in fearful scenarios. So I mention this partly because I find when I'm doing the course, it's quite a useful model to sort of place where kindness fits. So kindness is particularly associated with the soothing and affiliation system, which in a way what that points to is that we've all got the kit for kindness. We've all got the basic equipment there for kindness, but it can often be out of kilter because for some of us at least, our threat or our drive system can be too dominant. So it's helpful to be able to see the three systems, and also because of this thing of new mind that can get caught up. So if our new mind is being driven by the threat system, it can get things out of kilter as well. And the thing about kindness is it can, and activating the soothing system, is that that can help to rebalance the systems. But yeah, it's just, I find it useful, just it gives people a bit of a framework so you can sort of see where kindness fits in the overall scheme of being human. So yeah, so that's a bit about metta as a background. So I'm, as I said, I'm going to look at three applications. So I'm going to look at communication, particularly digital communication. I'm going to look at self-metta, and thirdly, I'm going to look at forgiveness. So communication. So, as we probably all know, at times communication can be hard. It's easy to miss each other, in a sense, to be on the wrong wavelength. When I was writing the talk, I was reminded of a poem that I particularly like by Billy Collins, called Putting Down the Cat, where you have a sense that the vet and Billy Collins, whose cat it is, are not quite on the same wavelength. So I'll read you the poem. It's quite short and give you a sense of this. So it goes. The assistant holds her on the table, the fur hanging limp from her tiny skeleton. And the veterinarian raises a needle of fluid which will put the line through her ninth life. Painless, he reassures me, like counting backwards from 100. But I want to tell him that our poor cat cannot count at all, much less to 100, much less backwards. So that's Billy Collins and the vet. The Buddha said, we're born with an axe in our mouth. So in a way, what he's saying is it's very easy to harm ourselves with unskillful speech. And one might say also to hurt others. I was thinking in the digital age, it's a bit more like we're born with axes in our fingertips. So I don't know if you've seen, the Marvel superhero Logan or Wolverine. And you get these, sharp points coming out of his knuckles. So it's like the digital age means that we, in a sense, wield more power. Now, fortunately, we've got some advice from the Buddha, not about how to communicate in the digital age, but about how to communicate. And there's quite a nice sutta where he gives some advice to a prince, Abhaya. So just to give you the background to this. So someone put Prince Abhaya up to try to catch out the Buddha. People seem to like to try and do that, try and catch out the Buddha. So what Abhaya was told to do was to ask the Buddha whether he would use speech that is unwelcome and disagreeable to others. And if the Buddha was to say yes, then Abhaya should say, well, you're just like an ordinary person using unwelcome, disagreeable speech. And if he said no, he would say, well, why did you speak to Devadatta? Why did you tell him something unwelcome? Because Devadatta wanted to be the head of the Sangha after the Buddha, and the Buddha said no, he couldn't do that. So off Abhaya trots to try and catch out the Buddha. Of course he doesn't catch out the Buddha, because the Buddha says, after he puts his question to him, he says, well, come on, it's just not, you can't give a yes or no answer to that, it's not as simple as that. And instead what he does is he gives some criteria for helpful communication. So the first thing he says is that our speech should be truthful. The second thing he says is it should be beneficial. So even if it's true and welcome, if it's not beneficial, the Buddha doesn't say it. And I was thinking maybe an example of that is flattery. Flattery might be ostensibly truthful and might even be welcome to the person, but it might not be very helpful to them. So the Buddha wouldn't say it. And then thirdly, which I think is particularly helpful, is the Buddha say you find the right time. So regardless of whether it's welcome and agreeable or unwelcome and disagreeable, you find the right time to say it. So I think we can use that when we're in, you know, thinking about digital communication with kindness. So, as I mentioned, you know, with the digital age, we've got a much bigger reach. It's more powerful, potentially, the effects of our communication, which is why being truthful is so important. We're unfortunately probably increasingly aware of things like fake news, which can have a very undermining effect. Also, we have less information about the recipients of our communication. I was quite struck by this, by a little incident I saw at home, which actually I saw face to face, but you'll see why it sort of seemed to me relevant. I was just going out the top of the stairs at home, and one of the guys I would live with said to another one, the first one said, "Are you in for dinner?" And the second person said, "No." And the first person said, "Good." Now you can see that could have been misunderstood. As it happened, the first person, probably seeing the sort of confusion on the second person's face, quickly clarified and said, "Oh, no, it's just that I'm cooking tonight. I need to know how many people are in for dinner." And also I knew that he hates cooking, so it was like, yes, one less person to cook for. But if it hadn't taken face-to-face, that could have easily, you could see how that could easily lead to a misunderstanding. And I don't know about you, but I've certainly experienced that with texts. I think this is for those of you who are in the early stages of a romantic relationship, I think that's been my experience anyway. It can be particularly unclear sometimes whether, is this humour or is this like a little dig? And, you know, I mean, we can use emoticons, but I'm afraid I don't think that's the full answer to, you know, texting. So, yeah, we have less detail. We have less information about our recipients, which means that it can be a bit harder sometimes to be empathic. You know, when we're face-to-face with someone, we see how something lands, and we can modify what we say. But I think when we're sort of tucked away behind our computer screen in our sort of safe space, we sometimes can say things we might not say, you know, face-to-face. So, I have four recommendations for digital communication with kindness. So, first of all, I think it's really important to check our sources. It's very easy to be careless and pass on misinformation. We might think it's true, but it's really good to check our sources. Secondly, I think it's very helpful to check our motivation. So again, coming back to these three emotional systems, what system's driving this? Is it our threat system that's actually going off and we're feeling a bit angry towards someone? Is it our reward system that we're wanting to perhaps, you know, be a bit competitive, or that we're a bit competitive and want to get one over somebody? So it's really worth just noticing that. I mean, it's, you know, because we will have those things going on. I think, you know, it's very natural, a sort of desire to, you know, want to appear clever. And if you'll just indulge me a moment, I'm going to give you another Billy Collins poem, which I think just sort of illustrates this, in a way, just natural tendency that we have to, want to be clever in a way. It's called, this one's called Child Development. As sure as prehistoric fish grew legs and sauntered off the beaches into forests, working up some irregular verbs for their first conversation, so three-year-old children enter the phase of name-calling. Every day, a new one arrives and is added to the repertoire. You dumb goopy-haired. You big sewer-face. You poop on the floor. A kind of Navajo ring to that one. They yell from knee level, their little mugs flushed with challenge. Nothing Samuel Johnson would bother tossing out in a pub, But then the toddlers are not trying to devastate some fatuous enlightenment hack. They're just tormenting their fellow squirts, or going after the attention of the giants, way up there with their cocktails and bad breath, talking baritone nonsense to other giants, waiting to call them names after thanking them for the lovely party and hearing the door close. The mature save their hothead invective for things, an errant hammer, tire chains, or receding trains missed by seconds, that they know in their adult hearts, even as they threaten to banish Timmy to bed for his appalling behaviour, that their bosses are big fatty stupids, their wives are dopey dope heads, and that they themselves are Mr. Silly Pants. So yeah, so we've kind of got that in them. I think it's a lovely recognition of that by Billy Collins, and we just sort of need to notice it and try and not let it too much affect our digital communication. And thirdly, I think it's really worth spending a bit more time just how is this likely to be received and could it be misinterpreted? You know, it can be very clear in my mind what I mean, but if I'm not careful, it might not be so clear in the other person's mind. So again, just to give you a little example from a text exchange I had with a friend. So my friend wrote, this is literally what he wrote, "Can I borrow your bike stop?" So I'm a bit confused, so I text back, "Do you mean bicycle or pump?" And he texts back, "Yes." So I'm still not sure. But obviously in his mind, it was very clear what he meant. And you know, I think we can be like that. We just sort of think, yeah, well, of course, it's obvious to me, and you still don't think about it. So it's really worth just giving it, you know, could it be seen, could it be taken in a different way to the way that I mean it? And then fourthly, the thing that's really saved me a lot of heartache is always reread before sending. It's so easy to miss that not word out, which then, of course, completely changes the meaning of what you're saying. Okay, so that's a bit about digital communication. Secondly, self-meta. So I think when we're doing the meta-bhavana, we're doing the first stage, it's very, very easy to get into a bit of a mess with doing it. So we sort of start, okay, first stage meta-bhavana, and we bring up the self, and up comes the self. And then, so we bring to mind ourself, and then it's very easy to start becoming aware of one's limitations. But then, so you become aware of your limitations, and then you try and persuade yourself that something different, like, no, you're lovely, you're marvellous, you're wonderful. No, I'm not. I'm not wonderful. I'm not marvellous. And you can sort of get into a bit of a rumination if you're not very careful with the meta, and then, bing, you're onto the second stage, and you sort of haven't got very far. So hopefully you do it in a more sophisticated and way. But from people I teach, I've known it to happen a bit like I've just described. So a couple of suggestions, and there's more in the book, but one I think is we can just simplify it a lot more. So one way that I find helpful is just simply to bring kindness to each aspect of experience as it arises, rather than to the self as a whole, which of course, as we know, as good Buddhists, is in any case a construct. So a painful sensation arises, we can bring kindness, we can bring metta to that. A thought arises, we can bring kindness to that. In fact, we could say that the act of bringing awareness to something is an act of kindness. So that's one way that can I find helpful. Another approach comes from a nice little story from the Pali Canon, from the Udana, of King Pasenadi and Queen Malika. So it seems like in the story, Pasenadi is having a little mindful moment, a little reflective moment, and he calls his wife Malika to him, and he says to Malika, "Who to you, Malika, is dearest in the world?" Now, if you haven't read any further in the sutta, you imagine that Malika is going to say, "You, Pasenadi, you are the dearest person to me in the world." But she doesn't. She says, it's me. I'm the dearest person to me in the world. But good on Malika, because she says, what about you, Pasnadi? Who to you is the dearest person in the world? And he admits, it's me as well. So the Buddha gets to hear of this, and he says, well, that's how it is. We are each to ourselves are the dearest. And he goes on to say that recognizing that, we should be kind to other people. So in a way, what this is saying is that, you know, basically we privilege ourselves. Our sort of default position is that the world revolves around me. And I think we can just recognise that and sort of tune into that as a desire for our own good. And if we're relatively psychologically healthy and in a reasonable state, that can be enough. We can just tune into that and just notice, oh yeah, I care about myself. And that can be enough. If, on the other hand, we're plagued with self-hatred or we're not feeling in a very good state, it can still be relevant, because even that sort of self-dislike and that self-hatred is a kind of self-preoccupation. In other words, it's a sort of distorted desire to be happy. It's actually quite often that sort of thing is quite often quite protective. We sort of put down ourselves before somebody else puts us down. So we may need to dig a bit deeper, but again, it can be a line of inquiry that can be fruitful in terms of self-metta. Okay, so now I'm going to go on to the third area, which is really about responding to hurt. So first of all, looking at our own hurt, so when we feel hurt. So when we feel hurt, the very easy natural response, the temptation, is to go into either blame or self-pity, often with righteous indignation. And as part of that, we can even go a bit further, which is to kind of flaunt our hurt for sympathy. I mean, hands up, I know I've done that sort of, you know, and then this happened to me. Can you believe it? No, did you really? No, it was really hard. So we can, you know, play. You know, some violins are going on in the background. So it's very, very, very easy and tempting to do that. But actually the Buddha is very clear that it's not a good idea. He says, those who entertain such thoughts as he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will not steal their hatred. So in other words, it doesn't work. That's what the Buddha is saying. It doesn't work for us and doesn't work for other people. And he goes on to say, not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. Unfortunately, it's very easy to get into a bit of a reinforcing cycle. So we feel hurt, we go into blame or self-pity, and then we ruminate on that and we start nursing a grudge, which then makes more pain. And we get what I think of as a sort of hardening of the heart. And then it's very easy to get stuck in a sort of victim mode, which unfortunately is not self-metta. So my suggestion is that when we're hurt, really our only solution is forgiveness, which means bringing metta to the situation. So it doesn't mean pretending that the hurt hasn't happened, as Bhante says, again in Living with Kindness. Feeling metta does not blind you to the facts. If someone is greedy or stupid, you see that they are. But with metta, you can always see through that greed or stupidity to the beauty of the human being. It is through metta that you can hold the two together, the ugly truth and the beautiful reality. And Lewis Smead says this, to forgive is to set a prisoner free and to discover that the prisoner was you. So I like that. It's like we get imprisoned until we forgive. And interesting, there have been quite a few studies done on forgiveness, and they show you if you practice forgiveness, you're less likely to experience anxiety, depression, substance misuse. You're likely to have greater emotional stability and life satisfaction. It's even thought to be protective to the heart. I found a nice little study where they divided people into three groups. They had to think about an offence, something that somebody had done to them. And then they were in three groups. So one was a forgiving group, one was a sort of angry group, and one was to have and one was a distracted group. So they had to think about the offence in one of those three ways. Then everybody was distracted for 5 minutes and then told to think about the event. And those who'd been doing the forgiving, their blood pressure fluctuations just stopped. So everybody, the other two groups, their blood pressure was going up and down. Presumably you start getting angry and your blood pressure goes up and you calm down and then it goes down again. But for those in the forgiving group, their blood pressure didn't go up and down, and it stayed like that for some time afterwards. So that was just one little study. So how do we do forgiveness? So I think one of the things that's important to recognise with forgiveness is that usually, unless it's a fairly minor thing, it's usually a process. I remember quite some years ago being hurt by one of my friends in a way that I didn't expect. And I noticed that my response, although I sort of think I was reasonably polite and friendly, it was somewhere like the heart had closed. And it took me quite a long time to work on that, to soften that and to open to him again. So I think in that process there are a number of things that can help. I think a starting point is to reflect on the desirability of forgiveness. If we don't think it's a good idea, we're not going to do it. And we can think of forgiveness as a present. It's interesting, it's got the word give in it, like giving a present. And I think also it's a very noble act to forgive. Secondly, we can tune into the hurt and meet that with metta, so meet that with kindness. Particularly, I think working on a bodily level can help with that. And part of the process is that we may need to forgive ourselves. We may need to forgive ourselves either for getting into the situation in the first place or for our angry, hateful responses that have been generated by the situation. And then I think it's helpful to try and understand the other person. There's probably very few Buddhas in the world, which means that people will make mistakes. We're all driven by craving and hatred. And from a certain point of view, you could say that we're all kind of doing the best we can. We're all trying to be happy and to avoid suffering. And although we sometimes go about that in stupid ways, nevertheless, I think it can be helpful to sort of tune into that sort of basic motivation. And then we can just really try and act on the basis of metta as best we can towards the other person. As Bhante famously said in an EBU meeting in Berlin, we can't always be happy, but we can be friendly. So that's responding to our own hurt. And then what about when, say, one of our friends gets hurt, so responding to the hurt of another person? Well, of course, we want to respond with sympathy, with compassion, with often in the Pali Canon the word is used anukampa, literally to tremble with, so we can feel with another's suffering. But I think we need to watch out, because one of the things that can happen very easily is that our friend is hurt, because you know we care about a friend, is that we can get drawn into righteous indignation. And then if we're not careful, we end up as moralism, which is described as metta, a moralism that can be unforgiving, that can be harsh and judgmental. And if we get pulled into righteous indignation, it doesn't help. It doesn't help the sufferer because it keeps them in the victim mode. And it doesn't help us because, you know, although we can get a real feel good because I'm on the side of right, it can just reinforce our egoism. So ideally, and again, this comes to the Buddha's criterion of when the time is right. We want to help each other to respond dharmically. And so part of that is simply a recognition that dukkha, unsatisfactory, is in the nature of existence. Sometimes I think we can have a bit of an unconscious belief that now I'm practicing the Dharma, I shouldn't suffer anymore. you know, I should be sorted, and you know, bad things shouldn't happen to me because I'm practicing the Dharma. But of course, that isn't true. You know, dukkha happens. So that's one side of it. And then the other side is, you know, helping our friend in a way to sort of move towards forgiveness, which again, as I said, might take time. It's a process. But to sort of nudge them a bit towards forgiveness. So the last part of the talk I wanted to come back to is this idea of metta as the path towards the goal, and indeed an expression of the goal. Again, this is Bhante. To miss the link between metta and insight is to miss the point of metta entirely. It's quite a strong comment. So often when we're talking about insight into the nature of reality, we talk or think of it in sort of cognitive terms. We talk about the three lakshanas of impermanence, insubstantiality, and dukkha or painfulness. And you know, clearly that's very, very helpful to you. It's a very useful way of approaching insight. It does risk underplaying the sort of affective or emotional side and the volitional side, because seeing into that actually is not just a sort of cool appraisal. And interestingly, you know, our experience of insight may not be experienced cognitively. So, but again, this is Bhante. Even the deepest insight need not be experienced cognitively. That is, it need not take the form of a logical proposition. You simply live it, experience it. There's a fully developed positivity and selflessness that is neither emotional nor cognitive. So, in a way, our sort of central delusion, if you like, is that we've got this fixed self that is we experience as being the centre of the universe. And, of course, often we don't notice it. It's only often if we don't get our own way that we suddenly find that we have got this self that we thought we'd, you know, completely gone beyond. So my, you know, we'll have all sorts of situations. I mean, you know, for my Polish friends, it says no cheese for breakfast, you know, when you're in England. So, you know, we can come against our preferences. My own sort of latest little working area is the dance floor. So, unlikely though it might seem, I do Argentinian tango. Now, just a little background for those of you not familiar with Argentinian tango. So when you're at a social, what you get is it's called a tanda, which is three or four dances, and then there's a cortina, which means you get some pop music to mark the end of the tanda. So the usual way it works, if you're a man, you ask a woman to dance with you. So I go off and ask a woman to dance with me. On a bad day, remember it's normally three or four dances, on a bad day, after one or two dances, she says, "Thank you." And that means you're dancing with rubbish and I don't want to continue dancing with you. For which it doesn't happen very often. But it's hard not to go inside when that happens. So, so that's just a little example of, you know, I don't get my own way. And suddenly I notice this self that sort of this, you know, I'm the centre of the universe, which hadn't been apparent with the other people I danced with where they'd said, "Oh, it was lovely." So that's the sort of where we can notice it. The thing about the practice of metta is that it erodes this sense of being the centre of the universe. So we have this idea, don't we? We talk about metta being unconditional in the sense of it doesn't preference the self over others. It's a love for all beings. So in other words, it's going beyond the self or the distinction. It's an expression of egolessness. Again, as Bhante says, if you're able to act out of metta, if you treat others just as you treat yourself, you're acting as if the distinction you unthinkingly create in your mind between yourself and others simply did not exist. In doing so, you free yourself from the power of the illusion of a separate self. So another aspect of metta is this thing that it's given up the desire for retaliation. So in a way, we can sort of see metta, or another way of thinking about it, is a test of the depth of our understanding, the depth of our insight. It's very easy to love everybody when they don't impinge upon you. It's when we get hurt that is the real test. And I think that's why forgiveness is such an important spiritual practice. And I think a good place where we get to practice this is in the Sangha. So sometimes it's talked about as, you know, metta being of the fabric of the universe, in the sense that metta being a natural response when we understand the way things are. I think another way of thinking about it is the more we see how things are, the more we're likely to develop friendship and develop sangha. And the deeper our understanding goes, the deeper our metta goes, the deeper our friendships will go, and the deeper the sangha goes. And the wonderful thing about sangha is you get to be involved with other people that you wouldn't necessarily choose otherwise to be with. I don't know if you've ever noticed that, maybe not. But I think the more that we're particularly intensively and sort of vitally, particularly sort of face-to-face interacting with each other, the more that we get to develop that understanding and quality of metta, and to, in a way, test out the strength of our metta in our interactions with a sangha, which inevitably is imperfect. Again, just in case anyone hasn't noticed that yet, maybe it isn't here in Bristol, maybe you've got perfect sangha, but let me tell you, if you think that, you're going to be in for a disappointment at some point. That is the practice, working with an imperfect sangha. So I just want to end with an image. It's an image you may be familiar with. So it's an image from the Buddha's life story before he gained enlightenment. So in one of the Mahayana sutras, the Lalitavistra, you get this description of the attack of Mara. So Mara, the force of craving, hatred and delusion, is trying to unseat the Buddha-to-be. And he attacks him with all sorts of weapons. And as the weapons meet the aura around the meditating Bodhisattva, the Buddha-to-be, they get transformed into flowers. They turn into flowers. So I think it's a very lovely image for metta. We can see metta as taking in what is difficult and painful and transforming it into something beautiful. And I think one of the things about metta is that the more we inhabit metta, the more we see the world as beautiful. Indeed, one of the traditional fruits of practicing the metta bhavana is that we become more beautiful. Again, you think of an angry face tends not to be a beautiful face, whereas even someone who's not conventionally beautiful can look beautiful when illuminated by metta. So there are an awful lot of arrows in this world, and let's make more flowers.